ho, ho, ho! Merry Christmas!
This is a special edition of The Stack live from the Monocle Christmas Market with me, Tyler Brûlé.
And me, Georgina Godwin. Coming up, we'll review the year in print from newspapers to magazines and assess the state of the industry.
And we'll also browse the culture pages. And our luxury correspondent will be here to guide us through the glossies. That's ahead on this very special edition of The Stack live from the Monocle Christmas Market here in London. Well, good morning.
Good morning. Tyler, it's all been quite a rush this morning because, of course, we've had unexpected rain and then this huge hive of activity. It's absolutely buzzing at Midori House.
It is. I bumped into a guest who's coming up, John Owen. I was just back from a run. No one even told me I'd be co-hosting with you today. I've had a shower and everything, and I'm back all within 15 minutes. So it's all a bit of a surprise today.
But that's pretty impressive.
It's good when you live next door to the office. Georgina, it's sort of the start of the review season now, isn't it?
Absolutely. This is when we take time and take stock and look back over the year. Of course, the thing that everybody's looking back at today is the life of President George H.W. Bush, who died in the early hours of this morning, 4 a.m., I think, GMT. That was around 10 o'clock last night in the States. And lots of very moving tributes being paid to him. But, of course, that's not coming up in the newspapers just yet.
No, that will be your fare for tomorrow morning's program, for sure. It's also amazing where you can be 1 week later, because I was thinking, like, this time last week, we were in Zurich. We almost got you in the lake again, but it didn't quite happen.
Well, and you know, you say you've just been jogging, but last weekend, listeners, I have to tell you, it was freezing cold in Zurich, and he was swimming in the lakes.
Yeah, well, that's what happens in Middle Europa. What have we got coming up today?
So we've got a couple of really exciting guests in the studio with us. We have Joy Ladiko, who is from the London Evening Standard, and we have John Owen, who is from the Frontline Club, but also a huge force in journalism, I want to say. Force, is that the right word?
Figure. I think force in journalism. Figure as well. You can still be a force. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm very well.
Good. Well, very, very, very nice to see you.
Nice to be here.
We'll be coming to, of course, a series of the front pages as well in a moment.
And, of course, Joy Ladiko will be commenting on that too. Hello. Thank you for coming in.
Pleasure.
I know that you're very excited to be sitting near the baby goats.
I am indeed excited.
We should introduce the animals, actually. Yeah. I mean, they're sort of just throwing it on people. But what's happening behind me? Because I can't see, so.
Well, we have a very sweet little donkey who, I think, is it called Philomena? I'm not quite sure, but anyway, okay. a very sweet donkey. Then we've got a couple of, well, so I was told that we had pigs and goats, but then it turned out that in fact what they were pygmy goats.
Oh, pygmy goats. Okay. Well, first, there's going to be a whole protest out front and within the hour, because normally we always have a reindeer. And of course, there was a story of like reindeer abuse earlier this year in the papers. So we only have one reindeer. They claim he's the biggest reindeer in the UK. He'll be here tomorrow. So I said, maybe we could have all of the animals that were in the nativity scene, but all I see is a donkey so far. No,
donkeys and pygmy goats, but also sheep. There are a couple of sheep.
I wanted
there.
A small camel.
Oh, that would have been nice.
I think a small camel would have been good.
But I wonder if we might get an intern to dress up as one.
Yeah, we could do that. But we've had enough stories about intern abuse as well. But anyway. let's move swiftly along on that. Should we look at the papers this morning?
Absolutely. So, of course, Brexit always dominates the headlines, and we're all getting slightly eye-rolly about that, aren't we?
Well, which is a shame if it gets to that. But you've got the Telegraph. Well, I see. You're poised with the Telegraph.
The Telegraph is the one that leads with Brexit today in the UK, and that is another minister has resigned from Theresa May's government. There was a joke that Jeremy Corbyn couldn't sustain, the leader of the Labour opposition, couldn't sustain any more resignations, but Theresa May seems to be giving him a run for his money at the moment. And this one has gone down on... I mean, the minister's resigned for kind of relatively obscure grounds. This one is on our satellite programme with the EU.
Or
non-satellite programme. Yeah. But, you know, when it comes to carving his tombstone, will it say Sam Gyimah resigned because he just disapproved of us pulling out of the Galileo programme? Who knows? Anyway, there's another one down.
And your read on that resignation, just because impossible task or...
I think he is positioning himself because December the 11th is going to be the crucial vote, and you can't really be in government and then vote against the Prime Minister. So that looks like another nail in the coffin for this deal.
No. Also, the Financial Times weekend edition is leading with Crossrail HS2 chairman to be axed. It says Morgan to leave within weeks. Projects run over budget. Ministers press May to act. I mean, this is just, you know, we heard so much, I think, very early on, John, about, you know, would there be time to focus on anything? And everyone said, well, of course, we can go through Brexit, but, you know, ministers will still have time. We see there's no capacity to do anything else, is there?
No, it's just taken over everything on print, bandwidth, and I think the papers are up to their old tricks. You're seeing the same old biases playing themselves out. The Telegraph spots every minister that may be leaving. The Daily Mail wants this agreement desperately. Now, post Paul Dacre and the new editor, and they're playing it out in their own biased coverage too.
And even the FT seems to have drifted in wanting this particular deal, I think possibly because their journalists are so bored of it, but that's causing a bit of a hoo-ha as well. The FT is normally thought of as the sensible paper, which can actually hold a resistant line against government without a problem.
Mm. Now, of course, the other big story that's being reported everywhere is the G20 summit, which is currently ongoing in Buenos Aires in Argentina.
Like the most hellish drinks party one could ever imagine.
Well, yeah, in a big overlit white room, yeah, as well. I mean, you, oftentimes you don't see the stage managing, but watching this play out on television last night, there were so many sort of ushers and porters kind of trying to put everybody into position. It was rather odd.
Mm, with MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, actually being slightly sidelined in the big group family photograph, right pushed to the edge, nobody wanting to be around him, despite his huge big high five with Putin yesterday.
Well, there's a wonderful little sort of sideshow that goes on then, which I think the Mirror has managed to decode the wording of, where President Macron goes up to him and says, look, you never listen to me. And MBS says, look, don't worry, everything's going to be fine, everything's going to be fine, I will listen, I promise I'll listen to you in future. Macron is saying, listen, I'm a man of my word and I'll do whatever. So we're trying to kind of get vignettes amongst these world leaders. I don't think I've ever seen something with such a lot of access to a private conversation. But Macron, you know, trying to position himself as a man of principle against MBS. I mean, it's hilarious. And Trump is trying to be...
What surprised me is that only the Times actually had the real shot, the high five shot. The others, the Guardian, had them apart, but you would have thought that, that was the shot, and you would have thought they'd all have been splashing that.
Mm. And we were missing Tante Merkel as well. I mean, the you know, poor lady, of course, her A340 doesn't quite work, has to get diverted to Cologne, and then she has to fly, I mean, really such a to fly in Iberia, then all the way to Buenos Aires as well.
I flew in Iberia across the Atlantic, really. It's a terrible fate.
Not great for a chancellor. But I also thought as well, it's like, it was quite amazing, German unions, whatever it is, also at a time when, you know, the Bundeswehr has been so sort of criticized, no backup crew for the flight either.
Quite extraordinary.
There was a second aircraft that could have taken her, but they were off.
Yeah, that they had to stand up. But you know what's also odd is that's not the first time that her plans have been derailed through mechanical failure.
Yeah.
Isn't that rather odd for a plane that's going to be carrying a head of state?
Well, there was a lot of chatter as well. It was the German press was very early on saying that, you know, could it have been that the electronic system of the aircraft could have been hacked? Because it wasn't a fuel valve. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't the landing gear. It was actually the whole comm system on the aircraft, which is remarkable. I mean, this is an aircraft for a head of state.
Mm. And of course, she was rushing there to be really the voice of reason at the G20.
Well, hopefully she's arrived by now, by this morning. So.
Well, yeah, she was meant to. One thing that really interested me about it all was Macron, who in the middle of this went off to a bookshop in Buenos Aires, El Ateneo, which is made out of an old theatre, so it's terribly grand. And Macron fancies himself a little bit of a writer. And he said to the writers, when this is all over, I'm going to get back to telling the real truth, meaning writing. What does that mean for what he's telling at the moment?
Well, there was an extensive interview with him in which he listed all the books he'd read, which were sort of 19th and 20th century classics. You know, he gives gifts, rather obscure gifts, of books to world leaders. He really is a bit of an intellectual who's having to talk the political jargon at the moment.
Absolutely. John, what's catching your eye in the papers today?
Well, since I barely had a chance to peruse them, really just simply grazing them for the G20 and the Brexit coverage.
There's a piece this morning, this is what the New York Times is leading on, quite a remarkable image, which I'm just going to hold up. And it's a view across Sarajevo, and it shows some tourists sort of visiting from Asia, you know, taking a photo op. But it says, Sarajevo hostel reflects growing dark tourism trend to sites of horror. And this is, you know, on one side you can say we can remember when Beirut reopened, and of course there was like this great surge, but I don't think it was really marketed as such. You know, this is also, you know, people sort of venturing back, but this just something quite, you know, disturbing, thinking of everything that happened during the Balkan Wars, and then people having an Instagram moment over the city as well.
Get something similar happening in Berlin, where it's now become, you know, almost a joke to walk past Checkpoint Charlie, and some of the kind of greatest cruelties of that division and communism is just wiped out and turned into a complete tourist industry. You know, World War One, to a certain extent, has the history of that. People do turn up rather respectfully for these things. I don't know how much they're charging for these Sarajevo tours. I don't know what sort of level of devastation there is that they're going to be seeing, but you know, it's a strange way of doing tourism.
Yeah, well, John, of course, your involvement with the Frontline Club, and that's journalists going to places like that all the time. Disaster tourism, is it a good thing?
Well, I was just thinking, Janine DiGiovanni, who was one of the fine journalists who covered the Balkans War, posted in Facebook something saying how offensive she found that. No, I think it's a rather repugnant idea.
On the bottom of the New York Times this morning, there's another interesting story challenging South Korea's beauty strictures. It says, growing group of women battle mania for plastic surgery and flawless looks. And it, we have an image of Kim Jae-yoon. She said she used to spend $200 a month, 2 hours a day, on her appearance. And it's about a growing backlash to the plastic surgery boom in the country.
And it's coming off the back of hashtag MeToo and all the rest of it. Joy, what's your feeling on that?
Well, my feeling, I know women in London who spend more on their looks and their Botox than they do on their mortgage. Me Too has been, I mean, it's sort of last year, it continues to roll into this year, and there's a certain pride now in attacking all the kind of cultural norms that have been imposed on women. Having said that, in a sense, I think the two things become extremes, because the glamour market continues. Instagram is full of pouting women who are wanting to look as beautiful as possible. So, you know, it's women being set against women, two different philosophies.
And the founder of Me Too, of course, has come out and said that it's become something that she never intended for it to become, that it has become this tool to attack men, she feels, rather than pointing out that there have been awful things happening in the past.
Yeah, and also it's become colonised by celebrities. So, you know, a movement that actually started from the ground, from you know, people on the street and in their work life, is now literally a kind of A-list campaign. And who's looking after the regular women?
In terms of the reporting on Me Too, we're going to apparently get the full New York Times account of Leslie Moonves and his cohort in terms of how they tried to shut down the allegations against them. And apparently the Times has put three reporters on this, and their final reporting is going to be available perhaps tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. So this will probably lead as a New York Times big Sunday piece then.
Yep.
Go ahead, Georgina.
Well, I thought actually what we'd quite like to do is just have a look at a bit of a culture story now. Mm. So I think what we'll do is actually cross to Matt Wolfe from the international edition of the New York Times. He's getting festive with Ben Rylan.
Ah, Eve.
Good evening, Mr. DeWitt. I had no idea you two knew each other.
This must be at long last our formal introduction. Until now, we've only met in passing.
That's how you met me. In passing.
Matt, when we watch old movies, we often see scenes involving the cast and, I suppose, Pat's crew of a stage production rushing away after the final curtain for cocktails into the early hours of the morning while they wait the first editions of the newspapers. And, of course, the reviews contained within the newspapers that may decide their fates. Now, one suspects that the industry today has changed somewhat.
Well, the scenario you point to is absolutely right. There are all these stories of Sardi's, the showbiz restaurant in Manhattan on 44th Street, where in the old days they would have, you know, the party, and then the first edition of the New York Times would come out at, I don't know, 11 or p.m. or midnight or whatever, and the review would be there hastily filed, and they would read the review, and if the review wasn't good, the party would end. And everyone would go home. If the review was great, the party would continue for days. Now it's very different. Critics go, they don't go to opening nights. They almost always go to late previews. Some exceptions, but generally that's the case. The New York Times work I do is a column, so it depends on when the column folds due. Sometimes I am turning something around quite quickly. The Ian McKellen King Lear, one of the highlights of this year, I had to turn it around very quickly. White Teeth, more recently, a play at the Kiln Theatre in North London. When I'm writing for the Arts Desk, where I'm the theatre editor, that's not a column, that's in response response to a particular show. And that we do turn around right away. So it kind of depends on who you're writing for and what the deadline is. But I think because of this tradition now of the late preview, it takes a little bit of the time pressure off. And I think that's a good thing for the industry and for the critic. It's good for the critic because it gives him or her more time to write a measured, balanced review. It's good for the industry because it means that the reviews aren't quite so kind of off the cuff. They're a bit more considered, maybe a bit more reasoned, not perhaps quite so much written in the heat of the moment, which can work well, but it can also work for you. It can also work against you.
Well, given that we are at the tail end of 2018, you've probably had plenty of time to consider what your highlights were, Matt. What's the first title that comes to mind if we talk about 2018's best stage productions?
In London, I would say two in completely different categories. In musical terms, the revival of Company, but it's a production of Stephen Sondheim and George Firth's 1970 show that's so different that it hardly feels like a revival. It feels like something brand new with a familiar title. In classic terms, I would say the National's production of Antony and Cleopatra. It is the Antony and Cleopatra we know and love, but it's rarely been as well served as it is by Ralph Fiennes and Sofia Akinado. So those are two familiar titles, both of which seem freshly minted. And I think when you go to a play that you think you know, you want to come out of it feeling as if you've never quite seen it done that way.
That idea of the revival is obviously something that we like to talk about on the stage because there's something uniquely fun about seeing something you know done in a slightly different way. But it's interesting the way you describe Company there in that it is so different that you can hardly call it a revival. Is that something that you find welcome today, given that we have seen revivals that perhaps didn't come across as being so successful? I caught a show of Carousel in New York a couple of months back and felt that it didn't really speak to me in any unique way about where we are today in the world or come across very strongly about saying something unique from the past either. I mean, that's how it felt to me, but perhaps it would be better to give something a new coat of paint, so to speak.
Well, if you'd seen the recent New York revival of Oklahoma, which of course is the Rodgers and Hammerstein show that immediately preceded Carousel, that would have been a comparable experience to seeing Company here, i.e. you enter thinking, oh, I know this show, and you leave thinking, God, I didn't know it was this show. So I love that about the classics. That's why the classics are classic, because they can take any amount of stretching and pulling that you can, you know, subject them to if they're durable. And these titles are durable. The thing about Company, much talked about, but it's the obvious difference, is that it's a show that was written for a guy. And in this production, Stephen Sondheim, the composer, and Marion Elliott, the brilliant director, have transformed the characters so that he is now a she, which isn't just a gender flip to be flip. It's actually something that completely transforms the piece because it has a kind of biological impetus to it that it didn't before about what it might mean to remain unmarried as a woman through your 30s, if you want to have children, et cetera, et cetera. So it has a kind of urgency and pathos that I think it hadn't possessed before. And Stephen Sondheim, the composer who's now 88, has said that he can't quite remember why in 1970 he didn't write it about a woman.
I'd like to propose a toast. Here's to the ladies who lunch. Everybody laugh.
Now, Matt, we are at that time of year when many people start scouring the culture pages to decide which festive show to pop along and see, and there are plenty to choose from.
Of course, the thing that England has uniquely compared, at least to America, is the tradition of the Christmas pantomime. That's something Americans think is, you know, from Mars. And there are literally hundreds of them across the UK. And they're jolly good fun if you like that kind of thing. Lots of audience participation. It's quite freewheeling. It's naughty enough to keep the adults engaged, but not so naughty that the children have to cover their ears. There's always a showpiece panto every year at the London Palladium, which has big stars in it. You know, it can have Julian Clary or Don French, people like that. So I guess that's kind of the big one in town. But you don't have to go into town. You can find one at, as they like to say, a theater near you. So that's one thing. The other thing is the incredible plethora every year of A Christmas Carol. You would have thought Dickens's story would be so oft told that the audience would be chiming along with the actor. But Simon Callow is doing his again this year. He's done it before. I would point towards the one at the Old Vic, which I saw last year at this time. It involves bell ringing, mince pies, sort of fun things descending from the ceiling. I don't want to give too much away. It's quite melancholy, which the story, of course, is the story of Scrooge and all that, but it also is ultimately joyous. So it takes you on a real journey.
You point to a lot of titles that we have seen many times in the past. And I suppose the way I approach it, that's not necessarily a bad thing, given that Christmas in itself is a tradition. So it makes sense to have a lot of these shows that are traditions as well. Is that part of the attraction here? All these other productions, Swan Lake, The Nutcracker, they make their perpetual returns every year. Is that actually part of the fun?
Yeah, that's actually really well put. I was going to say, as you were launching into that, The Nutcracker, I guess, is the dance equivalent in New York. It's the Radio City Rockettes, who are this kind of extraordinary kick line of very leggy women, not men, just women, and they appear at Radio City Music Hall for the holiday season, and they've been going since God was a boy. And I think there is something time-honored about it. I mean, there's certain things I guess you want at Christmas. You want your eggnog or your mulled wine or your wreath or your mistletoe, and these are the cultural components. And if that all seems a bit too samey, I suppose the challenge is to have your Christmas carol be different for whatever reason, to have your panto be different.
Do you also see that there are a lot of the classic musicals that tend to get a bit more attention over the holidays as well? I'm talking about acts such as 42nd Street, yeah, which is due to wrap up in January here in London, but it has been running for quite a long time here now. But it seems to me that there are even more people talking about that big classic musical at this time of year. Do those sorts of things tend to fall into the holiday spectrum as well?
Sure. I mean, they're not holiday shows. And of course, if you're the producer of 42nd Street, you would want to be playing to good houses 12 months of the year, not just 2 weeks of the year. But in London and in New York on Broadway as well, shows tend to clear out, or theaters tend to clear out the shows in them in January. January, February are very, very dead, dull months. So Christmas is kind of the last push. And certain shows, of course, lend themselves better than others to that. 42nd Street, I think, is top of the tree because it's big, it's lavish, it's spectacle. It's something that really does appeal to all generations. You could take your maiden aunt and, you know, your great grandmother and, you know, the kid who's never been to the theater, and everyone will get something out of the, I think it's a cast of 58 or something like that. That's a lot of dancing feet. And, you know, Kinky Boots, although, as the title suggests, might be a little kinky for your maiden aunt, that's another show that's closing in January that will probably have a last-minute push over the holidays. And it's got its quotient of, you know, baubles, bangles, and beads, as you would expect from the legwear implied in the title. So if your family is maybe a bit more progressive, that might be something that you would take them to. So yeah, and box office terms, there's no doubt that Christmas is what you bank upon, because the Christmas New Year's week is the one week of the year when even shows that don't do well any other time do well at that one time.
Matt Wolfe from the international edition of the New York Times, getting festive at the theatre with Monocle's Ben Ryland.
We're also here today with Joe Lodico from the Evening Standard, John Owen, a good friend around the microphone as well. We put them on the spot during the break. Joe, I'll start with you. Just before we go, journalistic highlights of this year. Not so much news stories, but anything that happened within this landscape that we're in that caught your eye.
Well, I think the story of the FT at the moment is fascinating. It's fallen into line with Theresa May, which is what most business leaders will be scratching their head about. It's always kept a distance. It's been Andrew Adonis has been attacking its owners, Nikkei, on Twitter, and demanding explanations from them. And yet the FT continues to ride very high. It's got massive digital subscriptions now. I think it's pushing a million. It's making a huge amount of money. And it's about to abandon its South London headquarters to move back to the Strand, to take newspapers back to Fleet Street, which is their historic home in London. So
I sort of wonder who's more excited. Is it the journalist, or is it going to be the pub and restaurant owners around the Strand?
The famous Elvino's, the great wine bar there that used to be full of journalists all the time and has gone quiet now and is just stuck with lawyers is finally going to get them back. I'm not sure how heavy drinking the FT crew are at lunchtimes, though.
Do any newspapers in London still have a bar? I mean, I think it was the Express was the last one that had a pub down the lobby.
The Evening Standard used to have a bar in the basement.
A Vice has its own pub, yeah. but nothing on premise, though. On premises, no, maybe not. John, what stands out for you?
Well, it's not a highlight, it's a lowlight. And it is the impact of President Trump's continuing harangues to his base about journalists as the enemies of the people, fake news. And I think it's had a terrifying ripple across the ocean and over here and in Europe. And if you just look at illiberal leaders such as Erdogan, or you look at Orban in Hungary, or you look at what obviously has happened with Khashoggi, the terrible murder and dismembering of him, I think, without saying it's cause and effect, nevertheless, what Trump is saying nightly, often at these rallies, is being picked up, is being parroted, and we now have 60-some journalists killed already this year. We have 270 journalists locked up. And I think, as Trump said about Khashoggi and about MBS, maybe he did, maybe he didn't, I think there are a lot of leaders around the world are using that same sort of bottom line. Well, we can kill them. Maybe we won't. Maybe we will. Maybe we won't.
Today, for people who are coming down to the Christmas market, we give proceeds to the Committee to Protect Journalists. So anyone who comes in, so please do come down. And on that note of the CPJ, Journalists Sans Frontières, do you think that there is enough activism right now amongst the journalistic community in terms of foundations and other pressure groups beyond newsrooms, John?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think that's the one thing that has happened. There is an extreme consciousness, and I think it has penetrated the public. I think they do now understand that the journalists are at risk, and it's not, you know, it's all over the place. Europe, we've had two journalists shot dead here, blown up in the case of Daphne Galizia last year. When you look at the CPJ, where have journalists been killed, and you put up the figures, by the way, it's Afghanistan, Mexico, and the United States, because you had a gunman go into a newsroom and kill journalists, so.
John Owen, thank you very much indeed. Thanks also to Joy Ladiko. The Stack will continue in its live edition, but for right now, Tyler Brulet, thank you for this show.
We're going to go for a little short break, but very good to see you. Have a super holiday. And you're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24. Stay with us.
The Escapist takes you to places less explored. In this special edition, we hop on a hodgepodge of connecting trains to recreate the storied journey of the Orient Express from London to Istanbul. We pass by drive-through liquor stores and small desert towns on an adventurous road trip from New Orleans to Texas, and visit Europe's highest airports. For the jet setters among you, we'll show you how to beat jet lag in cities from Hong Kong to LA and reveal our annual Travel Top 50, highlighting the best in transport and service, from the most picturesque rail journey to the airline you'll want to board for your next trip. Perhaps that next flight will deliver you to Cairo or Madeira or the island of Tsushima. We'll take you there and we'll tell you where to stay, drink and dine next time you find yourself far from home. We've even put together a wardrobe for wherever your travels may lead you, as well as an eclectic selection of books and songs to keep you entertained on the journey, when you're not too busy looking out the window spotting the places you've yet to visit. The Escapist, from the editors and bureau of Monocle magazine, is out now. Get your copy today or subscribe at monocle.com.
See that man sitting opposite you on the subway, lost in another world? Or that smart woman scribbling notes while having her flat white? Well, here's what links them. They're both listening to Monocle 24 via our free radio app that simply and seamlessly lets you tune in live or download shows for later enjoyment. Just think, you too could be settling back enjoying cultural nourishment in the form of the Monocle Arts Review, being briefed on the world of business with the entrepreneurs, or just enjoying great music with the sessions at Midori House. Come on, download the Monocle 24 app today, stick on your headphones, and have informed fun on the go. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24, a very special edition with me, Tyler Brulé, and Georgina Godwin. Well, it was another year of big changes at the glossy end of the newsstand this week. Condé Nast announced that it would combine its U.S. and international divisions into one business. Well, more on that in a moment. Amongst other things, I'm happy to say that Sagar Theda Rosen is here. Very good to see you.
Nice to see you.
Where have you been in the world since we last saw you?
Oh my God, everywhere. No, I've been traveling for a month in Dallas, in San Francisco, in New York, a lot of the U.S.
Let's spend a bit of time in Texas for a moment. I mean, it's interesting. You know, we look at a market like Texas sometimes in sort of a bit of a sneery way from other parts of the world. But if you're in the luxury, if they're in your business,
you know, Dallas is fabulous.
You want to be in Dallas and Houston and the money, the investment, and the state of retail is quite remarkable.
And the taste levels and everything. I mean, I was like, I got to spend a few days in Dallas, and I was really impressed with the retail landscape and incredible little boutiques that really, really well curated. So, yeah, cool bars, cool restaurants. I mean, I'm about to move to Dallas. Not quite.
Just maybe before we delve into some magazines, also a little bit of a review moment for us as well. If you look back at the last year, Sagra, just the state of the luxury market, of course, we've seen a lot of different things happening. You know, for example, Richemont, of course, you know, getting on to Chinese platforms. On the other side, you've got Chanel resisting going into e-commerce. A lot of different things happening. But if you look back at 2018, how does the state of the market look to you?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that it's changing. So, you know, it's still quite difficult to define where things are going to settle, right? So what we saw last year is a lot of change, obviously a huge move towards everything digital, online. I mean, when I was in New York, I was surprised about how many empty stores down Madison Avenue. I mean, I counted 25. And on the little walk that I took, which was like unheard of, like 2 years
you're
ago.
You're talking sort of from the 80s down to the 50s or something like that.
Yeah, to the 60s. I mean, that was like in less than 20 blocks. So that was like, so that's, I think, one of the biggest trends in luxury, which has been coming but we're seeing it really, really, really clearly right now.
And is that because trade is moving online, or people just don't have the money for luxury goods anymore?
People totally have the money. Absolutely have the money. I mean, the world economy in the last 6 years has been absolutely, absolutely booming. And I think that, you know, today you have a lot of kind of the kind of upper middle class being able to have the same goods as the kind of the super wealthy. I think what's happening, I think what's going to come next is like a very, very different market for the ultra high net worth customer that will not want to have maybe Chanel anymore or some of the things that are available to everybody else everywhere in the world. So I think that's where we're starting to see a lot of kind of very high-end niche brands coming up, like super expensive, more than expensive, super high value and super difficult to find, where you will not find them everywhere. So it's only just for people that are a little bit more in the know and that have already all the kind of luxury basics, so there's like Chanel or Hermes or Dior. So
I like how you refer to those as being luxury
basics.
Which is an interesting concept. I mean,
it is a concept.
But the other thing that you touch on as well, though, is it's like, what, you know, has the message or will the message get through? And you see, you know, you count 25 empty shops on Madison Avenue. When are the landlords going to realize as well that, I mean, something also has to give?
Yes.
Because, yeah, you know, once you've got three or four empty shops, it is very hard to then entice somebody to come in, no matter, you know, who the neighbor is. If you've got sort of three, you know, you see then a whole deterioration of many streets.
Well, I think some of it has to do, depending on the city, on the ownership of the street. And I mean, we in London, we have a very different situation with many of the very beautiful shopping streets that owned by the same landlord, right? Whether it's Grosvenor Estate or the Crown Estate. So they can manage the street in a much better way than if each space is owned by a different person. I mean, it's just going to be very difficult to agree who goes next to whom. And I think that for brands in a environment where, again, rental costs are still super high in those main streets, and where you're seeing like footfall decline, and you know, they're almost used more as a little bit of an advertising space. I think, but you know, in New York, I went to an also 10 Corso Como that looked fabulous, by the way, down in South Street Seaport, and that whole area is really, you know, looks to me that is very happening. Yeah. And so I was surprised. I wasn't surprised. 10 Corso Como is always like fabulous, but I mean, I spent like almost 3 hours there, and I called 3 Ubers. I had to cancel them because I wanted to buy something else. So they had like a super fun, well-edited, you know, range, you know, across the board, like everything, like from cosmetics to books to little trinkets to obviously fashion. So there is like real bright spots as well.
Mm. Speaking of well-edited, I know that there's a magazine that you particularly want to look at that we can't actually find because it's quite rare here in London. I'm talking about Goop, and of course the editor of that is Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yes. No, I couldn't find it either.
Oh, she's got I mean, she has a shop here now.
Yes. No, I didn't.
I was in for the store the other day. She didn't have it in the store, and it's interesting. It's an interesting segue as well, because it is also part of the Condé Nast world, bit of a custom publishing side project for them.
Yes, no, not anymore, as I hear. So, but since I think it was just taken in house, it was launched with Condé Nast, but then.
Oh, that's right.
I understand, there was like some fact-checking issues. That
No, you're right.
That kind of have, I guess, are part of the, I suppose, the Goop brand, you know, this type of climbs. But what I thought it was interesting was this, you know, in that way, you, Tyler, and Monocle have been quite the pioneers on, you know, on mixing, you know, making a much bigger universe out of a media title of a magazine, you know. And now so Goop was just another example. I think it's kind of the latest, but the one that I think is like is actually really, really interesting, that I did bring a copy, is Cabana.
Yes.
That you know very well. And I just bumped into the founder the other day, Martina, and I was just talking to her. They just opened a pop-up store in Burlington Avenue, in Burlington Arcade. And they've you know, continued to edit products on the back. Here it is.
Yeah, we have it to do this. Sago's got a very sort of large bag from Selfridges and has gone to help the newsstand there. Oh, there we
and,
go.
And here it comes. So this is a fabulous magazine. Now, it is one we've discussed on this program before.
Oh, have we? Okay.
We're always longing to look at the latest one. Big thick tome that you're just leafing through there, Tyler.
Indeed, and it sort of points, I think, a little bit. It's a commentary sort of on this marketplace, the magazine marketplace. When Sagar is saying that you almost have your print basics, or even your print luxury basics, and then you want something which is like this. And I'm just trying to see what the cover price is. Yeah, I mean, you're talking about a magazine which is 25 euros. Yeah. It's 29 Swiss francs. And of course it's, and again, it's that sense of you're waiting for it to come out like a collection.
And in fact, they have just done a 10 issue collection and pack, because people do collect these type of magazines, much like Monocle or some others that, you know, you can't get yourself to throw them away. They are so beautiful. They're so beautifully produced. They are so decorative as well that. They become collectors' items.
Absolutely,
I think.
I mean, just touching this—the fabric covering the cover is
beautiful,
and it's so tactile, isn't it?
And that kind of goes on to another kind of trend of the day in terms of magazines. I think it's like now you can choose which cover do you want, right? So there's like a lot of the editions come with 3 or 4 different covers,
and you buy them all if you're a real fanatic.
Yes, exactly. Well, I haven't quite bought all of the Cabana ones.
And especially a title like this one as well, which you want to have this on the top of the pile. I mean, this is something which defines your room. Where is it, you know, where is it sitting, whether it's bedside, whether it's on the coffee table. You know, you're going to definitely, if it's going to be a reshuffle of magazines, it's going to emerge at the top.
Mm. I just, that's what you just said is like so fascinating to me, because it really is almost a way to judge not a book by its cover, but a person by its magazines, the magazines that that they read.
I brought up Condé Nast Traveler, and this is a good example. Because, there was so much news that the start of the week was really focused on Condé Nast, yeah, saying that they're going to have, it's going to be one Condé Nast now. It won't be this divide between international and the U.S. It'll be completely integrated. Some of us might have seen that. And Condé Nast Traveler was the first title of the group where they said, mm-hmm, we're going to editorially be merging both the UK and the US editions. Is that something that, you know, at a time of consolidation, Sagra, was it bound to happen, do you think?
I mean, doesn't it make sense, especially for a travel magazine that I think has a pretty global audience, I will suppose, and is all about traveling? I think, you know, the world is getting more global. I think tastes and lifestyles are converging. So for me, it only makes sense that a lot of magazines are going to become more and more global. I think it has been a kind of a reverse of the trend where you had like a magazine that kind of franchised into different markets with a little bit of an angle. I mean, I think that like Interiors, I think, is about to become global as well. And we're going to see some titles, I expect, pop up with a much more global approach than right now. You have Architectural Digest, Russia and China and all that, which, by the way, half of it is the same content to begin with. So I don't know, you know.
But I sort of feel, you and I sort of share a love for a particular edition, yes, from your home. I mean, I think the Spanish edition of AD is probably the best now. It is the one, because it's a ray of sunshine. It hits your table. It transports. It's what a good magazine does. It transports you to Spain. You might even see someone's house who might be around this table in the pages as well, which is also sort of a nice reason to pick it up. But I think that's, you know, when an edition is really good, and as you said, this is a global franchise, there are many editions of it, but you get so, and it transports you somewhere. So yes, on one side I can see it, but then I really sort of yearn for a magazine as well which has such specific geography to it.
Yes, no, I think what happens with AD Spain, and I know, yes, we're both great fans, but is that when you pick it up, it's very different from everything else. So you recognize it by the page is like, okay,
you're not going to see the Moscow flat, because in the US edition, you might see the Moscow apartment, you might see it potentially even in the French one, but it's definitely not going to be in the Spanish edition.
No. It has a very different aesthetic point of view that is a little bit more, I don't know, accessible, but cool. I think we're still, and maybe we mentioned it before, I still think that the UK is missing a proper Interiors magazine. So I mean, there's a bunch of them, but you have the World of Interiors, but you know, something that is kind of usable. And the other thing I wanted to say with AD America, they have now launched an online area which is called Get Clever. It's an Instagram magazine that is actually really cool. It's much younger. It reminds me a little bit of AD Spain. It's with clever ideas, more kind of high-low. Mm. So I think that was an interesting development. I don't know if he's going to make it to print or not, but...
Sagra, thank you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue discussing magazine trends here on The Stack.
For a global perspective and some fresh ideas direct to your door on business, culture and design, not to mention fashion, travel and much more, subscribe today and join the world of Monocle. As a valued subscriber, you will get a 10% discount in all Monocle shops and our online store. You'll also be the first to receive exclusive invitations to our events and have full access to the magazine archives. In addition, all one-year subscriptions come with a free limited edition Monocle tote bag. With 4 bespoke subscription packages to choose from, you decide what suits you and your lifestyle best. What are you waiting for? Visit monocle.com and subscribe today.
Immerse yourself in the world of Monocle. Visit monocle.com. Listen live to our radio station, Monocle 24, or explore more than 5,000 hours of audio. Every minute of every show we've broadcast since we launched. And don't forget that we have over 400 films to watch and share, while magazine subscribers can log in and browse our complete print archive on screen. Our online shop is here too, which you'll find well stocked with clothing, books, travel accessories, fragrances, homewares, and more. Check into monocle.com every day for fresh news and opinion from our editors and bureau around the globe. Then plan a trip to one of those spots for business or pleasure with our handy city and resort guides. It's all there for you at monocle.com. What are you waiting for?
And you're back with Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, Georgina Goddard, also Sanko Marthea de Rosen around the table. Georgina, set the scene for us. We are 47 minutes into the start of the Christmas market. Normally we start at 11. I said this year, let's start at 10 and maybe sort of also chase the rain away. It's stopped, which is good. I have to say, this is, I think, our eighth year out here in the courtyard at Midori House. And it is the first properly soggy year, sadly. We've always been really lucky with the weather. The rain has stopped, though. We'll be happy about that.
It has stopped, and actually I'm really rather liking it because it's just giving you that grey close feeling where all the kind of warmness radiating out from the market. You've got the mulled wine.
Aren't you full of sunshine this morning, even though there isn't any? But the only sunshine we had was with Spanish AD about 2 minutes ago. Yeah. But
we've got lovely cashmere blankets over our laps, and it's really rather lovely. And I would urge you, if you're in Malvern, do pop down before it gets massively. There's so many people here already. It's wonderful.
No, it's great that people got the memo reading the newsletters and at their dinner. Santa's here. I can see, so he's here from Rovaniemi in Finland. I think Santa sledded down yesterday, and we have some animals which I haven't seen, but I know they're behind me. You've got a keen view of them.
Yeah, a couple of sheep, some pygmy goats, and a donkey. And it seems to me that the donkey and the goats are a kind of rivals for the same hay bale. I think the donkey seems to be winning on this particular one. A lot of kids looking at the goats, and then of course some fantastic retail stalls inside.
Yeah, as ever, we've mixed it up this year. So of course some great returning friends, the likes of another country are here. But I'm looking at microphones. We even have Sennheiser are here from Germany. We have a Sennheiser table. We've got an absolutely fantastic brand. Sagar, if you're looking for an investment opportunity, you need to meet the people from De Bon Facture. Are here from Paris, an incredible menswear line that we really really like. I don't think I'm wearing anything from today.
Check it out.
But they're good, and of course a full Monocle lineup as well. And as we're talking about magazines, a lot of outstanding print inside as well. Georgie, before we went, we wanted to maybe pick up on the Condé Nast story, which really sort of dominated, certainly the landscape of not just glossies, but a really significant media story bridging both New York and London.
Absolutely, because of course the chief executive stepping down amid big company shakeups. It's all interesting, glamour ending print publication. I mean, this is a very fast and moving and interesting story, Sagra.
Yes, and I got a copy of a Glamour magazine, which, I mean, I'm completely not surprised it's going out of print, this one, because it always targeted a much younger reader, a much younger girl. This girl is now fully online, fully digital, so. I mean, it's just the way of the world, and I think that we shouldn't kind of cry over that as long as, you know, they businesses continue to adapt. There is just no other way.
We saw the same thing happening with Teen Vogue, didn't we? For the same reasons.
For the same reason, and I guess it kind of makes sense, you know. I mean, is that this one? You can see it in the cover of this magazine who the reader is, right? I mean, it's like these kind of young girls that spend most of their lives in their phones, so they are not gonna pick up this magazine in the newsstand. And they don't even go to the newsstand.
And here's the curious one, though, as well, because here you have a title which also has spin-offs around the world. And I think this is often the very interesting case that the mother brand goes away, but still the brand lives on in other countries where they have, because we were talking about sort of licensees in other markets. So I think that's always curious to see how will a title evolve when you don't have the mothership to syndicate stories from, and also set the tone. So what happens with the editions that live on in other markets, aside from, of course, that Condé Nast gets royalties from them?
They're not going to abandon print entirely, though. They will still have special editions, like so their Women of the Year edition, I think, will still come out, things like that. So,
which is what we have. Which is
yes,
what we
this
have
is the Women of
right
the
now.
Year edition. Yeah. No, and I think it makes sense. I mean, sometimes, I mean, I'm a huge fan of print, so I buy a lot of magazines. My budget is quite high. I could probably pay a mortgage with it, but I'm like, you know, like Sex in the City with shoes. I'm the same with the magazine. So, but the other one that I always find that I always pick up is Vanity Fair, and I usually in like two or three editions. And obviously now we have a new editor at the helm and all that. But I still like it. I think that I haven't seen like a huge change in terms of content. I think maybe like I don't know, Tyler. What do you think?
You're more I think sort of specialist. I'm sure that people.
It's a little bit cleaner inside. I like a little bit more modern. No.
Yeah, I think they went through sort of a bit of an unfortunate cover moment when there was the change of editor. Yeah. And maybe it was sort of a bit of a reflection of the times. I don't know, but it has improved. And in fact, this current cover, the Lin-Manuel Miranda cover, it really sort of it stood out. You've got and it actually reminds you a little bit. I think someone was probably in the Vanity Fair archives as well. It has a real feel of the magazine in the early 30s. It reminds me of sort of Vanity Fair in the 30s, the run up to the war. There was like so many extraordinary sort of graphic covers that they did, and this has this definitely has shades of that.
Yeah, absolutely, more kind of visual tension, if you like.
Listen to you over there, visual tension, listeners.
But I mean, it's more kind of defined grids, and it's as you say, cleaner.
God, you're going to find yourself on the editorial floor. You're going to have a desk in the art department if you're not careful.
Yes.
Oh no, keep me shackled to the basement, please.
As it's actually cleaner, a little bit cleaner as well, is the new Tatler, you know, again with like a little bit of a redesign. I mean, it's still quite consistent with their core, you know, USB, but. You're starting to see a little. I mean, I quite like this. I've been like moving away from this kind of slow-y focus, very UK. It feels even just the shoes, the imagery is a little bit more. I don't know. Modern is not the right way. Kind of fresher, you know.
It's no longer the society diary for a kind of rather parochial set of English aristocrats.
I think it's trying to kind of. I mean, that's still the core, but it's still trying to kind of branch out a bit. I think we have it over here.
Just while you're talking, I have to tell you that Monochan is coming up behind you. This is our Monocle living logo.
It is. Right? It was one of our sort of great early and I think rather sort of clever investments that we. Our Jun Toyofuku in Tokyo had to go and find the maker, and they call these chans. I mean, chans are sort of mascots in Japan. So we went and found an incredible manufacturer. I believe they're in Kawasaki. So anyway, Monochan will be sort of hopping around Marylebone throughout the day, and one of the better gigs if you're an intern to get to dress up as a giant owl.
Yeah, I'm not sure who's in there at the moment, but
not sure. I think someone quite tall, because sometimes you can see if it's someone not so big there's sort of long yeah. Well, yeah, this right now you can see there's just boots and no legs. So
We're heading towards the end of the program, but before we go, I think a quick sort of final roundup of magazine titles for the year. Is there anything that has really, really excited you, Sagra?
Well, I think that we've talked about some of the more exciting ones. I mean, I've been buying a lot of the U.S. interiors, so I think so. But I was just like going to a couple of newsstands in the U.S. and here, and the thing that is quite interesting is that there is a real polarization of titles that I can see. So on one side, you see a lot of niche, beautiful magazines like with. You know, a beautiful photography, a really kind of distinct point of view. And then you see kind of the rest, which is a mumble jumble of all kinds of things, right? So that, I think, is one of the kind of the biggest trends that I see, which is a little bit a reflection of what's going on in luxury and in many other industries. I think that this is not different.
No, I mean, you have this incredible wave of startups. So a lot of titles. And it's interesting, almost like designer brands, a lot of them, our magazines, which are there for three or four editions, and they're gone. And I think we see the same thing as well with a lot of fashion labels. Some really interesting companies come along. They may not find the funding. They'd run out of steam, but they were great for those three or four seasons.
Yeah.
And then that's it. And they're gone. And I think the same thing happens in publishing, which is quite exciting. And those titles become collector's editions and you want to hold on to them. And then, of course, you've got those which, of course, you know, continue to endure as well.
Yes, absolutely. I think we're in the same. I mean, but there is a lot of like really ugly stuff out there as well, I have to say.
Well, when you mentioned the U.S. newsstand, I was in Los Angeles earlier in the week, and it is remarkable. And you know, as you're saying, I mean, whether it's sort of glamour deserved to sort of survive as a regular edition or not, there's just a lot of editing by numbers, not a lot of evolution.
No.
And you, when you look at then also the quality of advertising in some magazines, it's like it's really,
oh my God,
really
yes.
remarkable.
Yes, yes. And of course that, as you know, sets the tone for the rest of the magazine.
It does.
Visually, if anything else.
Yeah.
So if it's going to be like, you know, cat food all over, or you know, or like a cheap jewelry everywhere, I mean, it just sets the tone for the rest of the editorial in a way.
So. Absolutely. Well, nobody could ever accuse you of wearing cheap jewelry. You looking completely fabulous.
Well, you know me, like a Christmas tree.
And on that note, happy Christmas.
Absolutely. Sagra, very, very good to see you, and hopefully we'll see you over the coming weeks. There's a cocktail next week, so hopefully we'll see you there. For intent. Also next Monday night in Paris as well.
Oh, okay. Well, next Monday night is going to be a little bit
so any of our
and in Toronto, I here. I got
yeah,
the invitation
there's,
from
there's,
Toronto.
There's one
too.
In Toronto too. There's also Zurich. There's Zurich next week. So next week is indeed
party week.
You've been listening to a very special edition of the show live from the Christmas market here at Midori House in London. If you are around today, tomorrow, right up until 1700, both days, do drop around.
Absolutely. There'll be wine, reindeer, plenty of goodies to stock up your stockings all day today and tomorrow right here at Midori House. So today's show was produced by Ben Ryland and our studio manager was George McDonough. I'm Georgina Godwin and...
I'm Tyler Brulé. Have a good weekend. Thanks for joining us on The Stack.